I'm John Lund, and welcome back to Thinking It Through, a twice-monthly podcast where I explore the reflections and connections that people make to their personal history and geography. Over time, I'm not sure what's more interesting to me, the people expressing or reflecting their ideas of what it is to be human in their art, or folks living a life responsibly by providing for others and being a civil human being. Well, Roger Williams, now an 82-year-old retiree from Cannon Falls, Minnesota, and truly a son of the state of Minnesota, is a little of both to me. He's both an artist and somebody who's operated in a civil fashion, trying to make people's lives a bit better. Like so many people who toil behind the scenes in the state and local government, Roger sought to do what he could do to make things a little better for all of us who are lucky enough to live in this state. With his love of the land, all state recreation and historical areas, and a strong desire to improve upon what he knew as a responsible and civil government, Roger got up every day and went to work for his family, his fellow state employees, and the rest of us who claim Minnesota as our home. What follows is an edited version of Roger's conversation with me for a couple hours the other day at his home. Though it's remarkable in what it reveals about his life, his loves, and his work in the state of Minnesota, I believe we only scratch the surface of Roger's whole story. I'll leave that up to the rest of you to find out. Thanks much for listening. Now here's Roger. Roger, thanks for talking to me today. You know, you and I have known each other from the food shelf, but maybe before we get into talking about your life and places that you're fond of, you can tell me a little bit about your life these days and what you're all about.
My life these days, I retired in 2000.
Uh-huh.
Needed something to do to keep myself busy.
Now you retired from?
I retired from the state of Minnesota.
Right.
I worked there for 33 years. And then in 2000 or 89 or whatever, or 99, I was appointed to a 4-year term of the Metropolitan Council. So that provided a bridge, if you will, from work to retirement. It gave
right.
me something to do. As the former executive director of the Met Council once told me, you can spend as much time with the council as you have, because it'll eat up every minute that you have. But anyway, that was for 4 years, lots of meetings, all that kind of thing. But I started thinking about what I wanted to do with my time. And I'd always been interested in photography and had taken lots of pictures of the family growing up and
right.
vacations and all the normal sorts of things. And tinkered a little bit with nature, but didn't have the equipment to really delve into it to any extent. But I happened to come across some articles about bird photography, and that was of interest to me. And so I began to do a little research on what I would need by way of equipment for bird photography, and made some investments and began doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of been my primary hobby ever since I've retired. I also started thinking about how I could be of service, I guess, to whoever, the community in general. And started thinking about volunteer activities. I was invited by a good friend of mine from church to come to a Kiwanis meeting,
mm-hmm.
and never looked back.
Mm-hmm.
I joined almost immediately. It's a wonderful club. Our average age is 78 point something.
Mm-hmm.
So we are the older generation of
right.
North Suburban Kiwanians. There's also
right.
a younger version. And I... after about 2 years of membership, I became secretary, and I've been secretary now for 3 or 4 years, whatever, which I enjoy because it keeps me busy.
Right.
There's a lot of thought that has to go into keeping track of the records of 59 people and
right.
what they're doing and where they're living and
right.
make monthly reports, both the board of directors here.
Are you the guy that does the minutes?
I am lucky. I do not do the minutes. I don't know how I got out of that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
No, I don't like to make minutes, but I do take, I record all the volunteer hours for the month
right.
and all attendance and all that sort of thing. And then I prepare reports for, we meet at the Oval
okay.
in Roseville,
yep.
the skating rink. Once a week, we take the big room and
right.
we pretty well fill it up. We normally have, 40, 45 members
mm-hmm.
on a normal day.
And
we always
that,
have a speaker.
Yeah,
yesterday, for example,
that, yeah.
we had the Secretary of State, Simon.
Okay.
And people of that caliber
mm.
are fairly frequent
mm.
visitors to our Kiwanis Club. It's an amazing group of people. There are a lot of retired University of Minnesota professors,
mm-hmm.
St. Paul campus, agriculture-related,
okay.
Food science,
right.
that kind of thing. And so the speakers are often grilled with questions that they just don't anticipate from this group.
Right.
I mean, they normally go to a group,
right.
they make a presentation, they ask if there are any questions, and there aren't any, and they say goodbye. Yeah. And they, you know, they get 5 minutes into their presentation, and they're already bombarded by all kinds of really, really deep and relevant questions. Yeah. So anyway, that's Kiwanis. And in addition to that, Kiwanis volunteers, we volunteer as a club about 400 hours a month at Food Shelf, primarily the one on Hamlin Avenue, Habitat for Humanity, Bridging.
Is that furniture stuff, the Bridging?
Bridging is, it's actually a warehouse at the present time. It was started by one man who was now 94 years old, who had some extra stuff in his basement and wanted to know how he could transfer that to people in need.
Mm-hmm.
And it's growing from there.
Yeah.
And now they serve, I don't know, for like 40,000 families a year or something like that. They will pick up furniture. If you are cleaning out your house or grandma's moving or whatever, and you have furniture, you can call them and they will come actually carry the stuff out of the house and, and take it to Bridging. And then when a family is referred to Bridging by a certified social service agency, they can come in one time and they can pick out as much as they can use in their abode. You have to have a place and you have to be referred by a proper agency. We have people who work in the woodworking shop. We have people who work in the warehouse, moving the furniture up and down and all that sort of thing. Kiwanis Clubs got together about 3 weeks ago and we put together 84 dressers that come in a kit like IKEA.
Right.
You take it apart and you, you know, put all everything together. We all together put 84 dressers together, and that was enough for 1 week. And Bridging, so that gives you some idea of the number of people that are served by that facility. So.
And are they locals? They're primarily Minneapolis, St. Paul.
I think they're primarily in the metropolitan area.
Right.
I don't know what the service area is for Bridging.
And that's a again, that's part of Kiwanis. They reach out and kind of bridge with Bridging.
Kiwanis has sort of adopted some organizations over the years, and Bridging is one of them. And like I said, Food Shelf, Habitat for Humanity.
Right.
We have one member who volunteers at the Transportation Museum and the Science Museum every month.
Right.
Just, you know, helping people find their way around and that kind of thing. And we also tutor. That's something we started in our club about 3 years ago, where we link up with the schools, either in New Brighton or in Roseville.
Okay.
And for 1 day a week, for about an hour, we tutor either a first grader or a second grader in reading proficiency,
awesome.
Which is a lot of fun.
That is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Big eyes, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah, I get a big hug when I walk into that.
I know.
I mean, it's just so wonderful. You walk into the room and your little guy is doing something, he's not paying attention, and pretty soon a classmate will say, Royal, and he'll get up and he'll look and he'll come running over and give me a hug, and then he'll go and get his stuff, and away we go to a room and do the reading. But it's really cool.
It's true. It's funny. It's
it's a nice experience.
Well, that's great. So you guys are doing some of that. And
we do that, and kind of an offshoot of my photography of birds is my volunteer work for the University of Minnesota Raptor Center, which is part of the veterinary medicine department, I guess it is, at the university. And the Raptor Center is known internationally, and it rehabilitates injured hawks, owls, and eagles.
Right.
There are many volunteer opportunities. I chose what's called the transport crew.
Right.
So when someone finds an injured bird hit by a car or what fell out of a nest, whatever, they will call the Raptor Center, and the Raptor Center will talk to them and try and find out some details about, you know, what happened and how bad is it, and is it a matter of just putting the bird back in the nest, for example, or is there really a need to bring it into the center? And if there is, then they will call one of us on the transportation committee, and we will go out and pick up the bird and bring it in. Then it will be rehabbed. Sometimes we also get to release the birds after they're rehabbed, which is always a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah.
And we try to take them back to the vicinity in which they were originally rescued, because they're familiar with that with that terrain.
Right.
And that's fun. For the last 2 years, I've driven about 2,000 miles each year, picking up the birds and bringing them in. And I think I brought in 7 eagles.
Whoa.
And unfortunately, just about all of them have suffered from lead ingestion, from either fishing tackle or fragments of bullets.
Buckshot?
Fragments of...
Okay.
But more oftenly, it's from a gut pile from from deer, because when the bullet goes in, it tends to separate, and you get these little lead particles, and of course the eagle ingests them, and it doesn't take very much to put them down.
When you go to a site, it's varied. You're working with different people probably all the time, quite a bit, right? With like a just a neighbor who found something and called it in, or a sheriff, or I don't know what.
In the case of eagles, it's virtually always a game warden.
Okay.
Because they're a federally protected bird.
Okay.
And usually the injury was reported either to a tribal game warden.
Okay.
From one of the Indian bands or Minnesota.
How far will you drive?
I've gone
100 miles?
Well, one trip for eagles from here to Mille Lacs is not unusual.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of eagles up there.
Right.
The longest trip I took was 350 miles. And it all hinged on one letter. Raptor Center said it's up at Stacy.
Uh-huh.
And Stacy is just north on 35.
Right.
Well, when I got the instructions from the people downstairs at the Raptor Center, it was Tracy. And Tracy is in a different part of the state.
A different direction.
And I thought, well, I've got some time.
I'll go to Tracy.
I haven't seen that part of the world for a long time. But it was a 350-mile
trip.
Put
some more gas in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I do is, and it's not much of a volunteer activity from the standpoint of serving the community and so on, but I do belong to the Roseville Optimist Club, which started about 2 years ago. I think the first meeting may have had 20 people. The membership is now well over 100.
Mm.
It's just taken off. Mm. And that's another situation where we have marvelous speakers, politicians, people who have made their life study in improvement of management skills and that type of thing.
Right.
A lot of corporate folks.
And
it's once a month.
Right. And there are optimist clubs around too, right? That's an organization.
International.
As
well. Well, we've had, you know, George Latimer. Just to name a few, George Latimer a couple of times.
Right.
George is just wonderful to listen to. He has such a beautiful take on life.
Right.
Dernberger,
right.
Former U.S. Senator, the chief of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I mean, those are just some of the caliber of the people. That
right. Do you guys have a secret handshake?
No, we don't.
No secret handshake.
Generally just wave and say hi. And,
right.
and try to remember each other's names.
Exactly. And the photography that you're talking about, we've talked a little bit about this because I'm interested as well, and just in a really amateurish way of just using a camera. The taking pictures of birds and so on. Tell me a little bit more about that, or your photography work. What kinds of things have you done along those lines in the past few years, taking pictures, or how is that a part of your life, your retired life?
Well, camera's always handy. There it is on the table.
Yeah.
Ready to go.
Yeah.
Where I live, this place.
Right. And we should tell people, where are we?
We're in Shoreview, overlooking Snail Lake.
Right.
We're not on the lake. We don't have access to the lake. There are houses down below, but it's probably a 45-degree slope down to the road and those houses.
Right.
And
right.
It's all woods. All heavily populated by oak and mostly deciduous species. And it goes for miles. This strip of land goes for miles along the lake and then off into the park and so on and so forth, Snail Lake Park. So it's a runway, and we get deer coming through frequently. It's very difficult to grow flowers around here because the deer find them and eat them up. And wild turkeys, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I saw one hen last spring with 15 chicks. I guess it's what you call a baby turkey, isn't it? Or a turklet.
A turklet. Right.
Anyway, turkeys all over the place, but they don't.
Turklet.
They're not a bother.
Yeah.
And then fox and coyotes and whatnot go running through.
Mm-hmm.
And as recently as the night before last, there were two barred owls that flew in and perched in a tree. I just happened to be looking out the window.
Out here?
Yeah, and that big oak branch that you
man.
Can see, and they the barred owls raised a clutch of owlets last year, and I'm hoping that they're back in the same place, which is a little further to the west from here.
Uh-huh.
But I'll walk up there and see if I can find the nest.
And
so anyway, that's where we are in Roseville. But as far as birds, I used to start by probably walking the Rice Creek Trail that ran from County Road I south in the Arsenal property. Mm-hmm. And I would do that with my dog. Mm-hmm. And every day we'd go out there, well, every day or close to it. Every day we'd go out with a camera and just take pictures of whatever we happened to see. It'd be songbirds, it might be a bird flying, there were osprey, and we were trying, you know, she didn't help. Well, she did. She was good at finding things sometimes that right. I couldn't find.
Right. What kind of dog?
German Shorthair.
Ah.
My Sophie.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, she would do her thing, and I would do my thing, and so that's kind of where I started. That was a good place. It had a lot of birds, a lot of activity, and there was some scenery if I wanted to take pictures of not cattails, but milkweed pods and that kind of thing in
sure.
the fall. I could do that. And
sure.
it was close to home. And then I would branch out. There's places in Wisconsin, Crex Meadows, which is famous for its sandhill crane migration in the fall. There's the Sherburne National Wildlife Refuge, which is north by Zimmerman, about an hour north of here, which is a great place to photograph. And then there's the Mississippi River down south for eagles,
right.
around Red Wing and
okay.
so on. There's Monticello in the wintertime for trumpeter swans because the water stays open. The Mississippi stays open because of the discharge from the nuclear power plant upstream.
Mm. Yeah.
And so there are hundreds, if not thousands, of trumpeter swans, and you can get pictures of them.
Hmm.
And then for a number of years, my former wife and I went to Florida.
Uh-huh.
And would spend a week or two in Florida
mm-hmm.
Photographing birds primarily in the morning and late afternoon. And of course, you get entirely different species there than you get here.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, yeah. And then the whole idea of kind of being in nature, I mean, as you talk about that part of your life, which is still, and I know from experience, you still really enjoy it. And just looking out your window, you know, is. Like you said, seeing some owls and things. Such a, it's kind of a meditative act without being called that, really. It's almost like, you know, the old cliche, you're one with nature without really self-consciously thinking of that and being able to be out doing that. You also must have a lot of patience mm-hmm. if you're looking for birds and animals because not everybody can do that.
I am not known as a person that has a lot of patience for people.
Hmm.
I just don't.
Yeah.
But I can literally stand for hours and wait for a shot
mm-hmm.
of a bird or mm-hmm. some kind of a critter.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I guess meditative is a pretty good word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has to be. There's something going on inside of your noggin when you're doing that.
Well, I think part of it is a creative process, too.
Yeah.
After you've photographed things for so long, then you stop trying to... You don't get excited about just taking a picture anymore.
Right.
What you want is a picture that shows that animal, bird, whatever, doing something.
Right.
It's not a matter of just, oh, there's a robin. Click, I'll take a picture.
Right.
No. Now you want a robin pulling a worm out of the ground.
Right.
And you want to take that picture just at the right time,
right.
with the right background, with the right light, and so on and so forth. So
right.
that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you get there. Otherwise, it's boring. You're shooting the same thing over and over and over.
Right.
And you, why? Why?
Right.
Everybody does that. And you don't want to be everybody. You want to,
right.
I mean, you want to try and excel,
mm-hmm.
push yourself,
mm-hmm.
if you will, like
mm-hmm.
in music or art or anything
mm-hmm.
else,
mm-hmm.
and to do something that somebody else hasn't been able to do.
Right. It's interesting. I was reading the late Mary Oliver. She's a poet that recently died, and she's put out a series of essays about somewhat of a process of sitting down and writing poems. One of the things that she does on a regular basis is she's out in nature, and she's just observing, and it's her descriptions of it to people that aren't aware of that might seem really kind of descriptive and boring, but you know, noticing the way that the tree is folded over or the way the sun is hitting a particular nest at some point or whatever. That sounds like a skill that you've developed over time just to capture animals in their natural.
I was reading one of my magazines that I get from one of the nature organizations
mm-hmm.
that I support, And I was reading one last night, and it showed a picture of a Japanese woman leaning back in a rock. She was standing up, but she was leaning back against a rock in this beautiful, beautiful setting, all natural, not a Japanese garden or anything like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a name for it, but it's a reflective, kind of meditative process that Japanese have been practicing for some time, and it's starting to catch on here, where you literally just go out and with nothing on your mind in particular, and you just look, and you just relax, and you drink it in.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can get some young people to do that and get away from their devices.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
Your interest in this stuff is fascinating to me, and I've really enjoyed it. You made a convert out of me and looking around, at least at birds that are flying over my head. I used to be concerned about things pooping on me, but now I'm looking at them with a whole new eye, just because of the cranes that we, sandhill cranes that we looked at up in Grantsburg. That was a wonderful trip. I love that.
It was fun watching the expression on your face.
Yeah. Well,
when they came in that night.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. I mean, the sun going down on one horizon, the moon coming up on the other horizon. Let's go back a little bit, if we can, back into your life. You kind of have an idea now of, you know, who you are at this point. Somewhat of an idea. We're not exploring all of Raj, because I don't have enough room on this disc to explore all of you. But let's talk a little bit, you know, in this thinking it through kind of thing, what I used to do with kids, and I shared this with you, that I want people to think about their own personal history in terms of who they are today. A couple of things, it seems, are coming out, you know, just as you talk about who you are today, be it intellectually curious about a lot of different things, hearing these speakers. You enjoy affiliating with different organizations that allow that to happen. You also enjoy being alone and being private and enjoying nature on your own terms. Where does that come from? I mean, do you see that coming out? I know that you're originally from Cannon Falls. Did, as a child, were some of these streams in your life, this kind of love of nature, curiosity for how things are, how things were? Or is that the product of not having to worry about swimming in a bureaucracy at the state of Minnesota?
I don't know where it all came from. Mm-hmm. My dad was town doctor and served a very large geographic area, and he was gone a lot. He was not. I mean, those were the days where you treated people at home, and you made house calls, and sometimes the house calls were, you know, a half hour, 45 minutes out in the country. He was a wonderful doctor. He really gave everything that he had to his patients. But that also meant that he wasn't necessarily at home a lot. My mother was very artistic. She was really from a nobody family. They were a farm family, and I don't mean to denigrate farm families, but I mean, compared to where she went, her sister, her brother, and her maybe dad and mother to some extent, not only had their own farm, but they also worked at another place that had a name, and I'm not thinking of it. But it was owned by Frederick Underwood, who happened to be the president of the Erie Railroad.
Hmm.
And that farm was very close to their farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so they signed on sort of as workers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Underwood met my mother. She had a fabulous voice, and he saw that voice, and he was a very cultured person from New York.
Okay.
Lots of money, obviously, and persuaded her to go to St. Olaf, and which she did, and she joined the St. Olaf choir.
Right.
And she is one of very, very few people who soloed all 4 years that she was at St. Olaf.
Right.
Went all over the world with the St. Olaf choir,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I say this farm girl,
right.
literally,
right.
who happened to meet someone who
right.
appreciated her talent and
right.
got her moving.
Right.
And she was a very good mother. I think the thing I remember the most is her insistence that all of us take piano lessons,
mm-hmm.
which I did not appreciate at all. I wanted, it was Saturday afternoons of all the worst time.
Right.
You know, you wanted to be out with the boys and getting
right.
digging in the dirt and
right.
you know, doing whatever. It was real torture.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did that. And
right.
But she died when I was in seventh grade.
Mm.
And I think, I have no way of knowing this, but I think had she lived, she may have, she would have wanted me, I think, to have a musical career.
Right.
But I think she would have, I don't want to say pushed me in that direction, but because push is not a good word, but directed me that way.
Encouraged you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really think I would have been very good at music.
Right.
I think I could write music.
Right.
I certainly could play music.
Right.
And it's kind of a big part of my life.
Do you play music? Do you play it?
Not anymore.
Are you
not
able anymore. To? Were you able to?
I played piano for I don't know, up until I was maybe a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
But I played a tuba in the high school band from really early on. I mean, I was, the horn was much larger than me when I started.
Right.
And up through and after high school, because I used to come home and we would have concerts in Cannon Falls. Yeah, marching band, concert band, the whole business.
Yeah.
And then it was fun during the summer because kids would come back home and we would automatically go to band concerts or to band practices and play in the concerts.
Right.
So we'd all sort of be together again as quote unquote graduates or alumni or whatever.
Right.
And then I also sang in the choir.
Right.
In both the church and in school.
You've mentioned to me that music, even A Perfect Night for You, is listening to music, classical music, right? I mean, it's on in the background. You can hear it. Even I can hear it, yeah.
I listen to music all the time.
All the time. Yeah.
But not necessarily classical.
Okay.
I really like some of the music on NPR, on the Heartland.
Yes.
You know, just guitar and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And I like 81.1, which is jazz. And so I keep going back and forth to find out what I like.
Yeah.
And I carry a couple of CDs with me as well. But
And
I'm always singing.
I
have to catch myself because I never know what it's going to be, and it could be something from a church service 10 years ago.
Or a show tune.
It could be anything, and all of a sudden I'm just, and sometimes I use parts of this one and parts of that one, and I put this song together on my own, and I'm just not even conscious of
all of a sudden you're like Gordon McRae.
What
a beautiful morning.
I'm not really singing, just kind of humming
okay.
and feeling the beat and so on and so forth.
Right.
So anyway, I do like that. So I graduated from Cannon Falls in 55.
Right.
Had decided that I wanted to be a landscape architect. And I didn't know a great deal about landscape architecture. But I went to the University of Minnesota for 1 year. A friend of our family had taken me to the university the summer before and introduced me to a guy on the St. Paul campus. Phillips was his name. He told me about this wonderful program that they had at the University of Minnesota on landscape architecture. So I went there for a year, and I realized halfway through that was a real ruse, that it had nothing to do with landscape architecture. But I did take all my courses, got all the basic courses out of the way, and transferred the next year to Iowa State and went 4 full years there and got a degree in landscape architecture.
And you were interning as you were going through later on in
every
college.
Summer.
Every summer.
Every
you were,
summer
you
I
were
would,
working
I
somewhere.
I would work somewhere, generally in Minneapolis with an architecture firm or a landscape architecture firm or so on. Before that, the summers were usually laying sod.
Yeah.
And that's where I probably got the skin cancer.
In your undergrad work in Iowa State, is there a particular professor, a particular area of study, that a course or a series of courses that you really enjoy, that you can recall, hands-on or?
No, I think the design courses that I took both in architecture and landscape architecture were my favorites, and I enjoyed the professors, that were teaching them, there was a lot of other stuff, LA history and so on, that taught us a lot about the old gardens of England and that kind of thing. And that was interesting and so on, but it was more fun to
the design stuff.
Put the lead to the paper and actually try and create.
When you left Ames, then eventually you got employed as a landscape architect or working as a landscape architect,
When I graduated from Iowa State, it was at a time when you were either going to be drafted or you were smart, you enlisted, and so I did. And told them
like
that.
This is like 60, 61, 62?
No, that would have been 60, probably. I probably went in the Army in the summer of 1960.
Okay.
And that's when I graduated, so there was no time in between.
Yeah.
I had enlisted under a program that allowed you to more or less indicate where you wanted to be stationed, and I told them Germany. And so after basic training in Fort Hood, Texas, I went to Germany. And
why Germany?
Well, it was out of Korea or the Orient, during wartime. There was no wars.
Right.
But I just thought Germany would be wonderful.
Right.
And then being able to travel around and
right.
see Europe, and which we did,
right.
a bunch of us traveled together. So, I had.
Were you in the Army for a couple of years?
Mm-hmm. I had a great time in the Army.
Yeah.
I had prime jobs.
Yeah.
I can't complain about my time in the Army at all. We were there when the Berlin Wall was built.
Right.
And that caused real angst because of our location and the fact that if the Soviet Union invaded the United States, they would have come right over the top of us where we were.
Mm. So you're red alert. I mean, you're not alert. You're watching things carefully.
Some people were extended. Their rotation date was at a certain time so that they were not allowed to go, and they had to extend, I think, for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But mine just happened to be far enough out so that things had settled down enough so that, you know, pretty certain that there was not going to be an armed conflict. So I was able to come home.
Where were you in Germany?
Fulda. We were an armored cavalry company, and our job was to patrol the border between East and West Germany.
Okay.
Most of our troops, our line troops, were at the border every day.
So you left the military then after a couple of years, and then did you parlay that into an architectural?
I had worked for a firm
job.
The summer before I went in the military.
Okay.
I guess it must have been between my junior and senior years in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a firm. So when I came back, I looked them up. They had an opening for a landscape architect. They were primarily an urban planning firm, or not urban, just planning firm. And they had bid on and won a contract with St. Louis County, which is Duluth, up to the Canadian border. As part of the bid process, if you will, they had agreed to move the offices to Duluth because St. Louis County is so large that in land area, that they didn't think it was something that could be done from the Twin Cities. So based on that and some other things, they got the contract. And so here I am, fresh out of the Army, 20-some years old, looking for a good time, and I'm told that the company that I want to work for is moving to Duluth, which was really on the outs in 1962-63.
Right.
People were moving out of Duluth. Be that as it may, I went to Duluth. Yeah, I worked for a multidisciplinary firm of architects, planners, and I was the landscape architect. Worked there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, something like that.
A lot of driving around? Or were you going?
Oh, yeah, because hardly anything was in Duluth.
Yeah.
I mean, we did some work in Duluth.
I
worked on the Fifth Avenue Mall, which
yeah.
connects the city
yeah.
center with the arena auditorium, and I did
yeah.
some residential work and
yeah.
and school grounds work. But we did a lot of work on the range, Tower, Sedan, up in that area, Ely, all over.
And there are
Hoyt Lakes.
Were you the only architect? Were there a few of you?
I was the only landscape architect.
Oh, wow.
There were architects. We were affiliated with an architectural firm in Hibbing.
Okay.
A very well-known firm in those parts.
Okay.
Who did a lot of church work and school work. So they had, I don't know how many architects, quite a number, and engineers.
Yeah.
Civil engineers, and I was the landscape architect.
And then you left that and eventually ended up with a DNR, is that right?
Yeah, my wife and I wanted to get out of Duluth. We had had our first daughter at that point, and my dad happened to hear about a job. My dad was in the process of building his dream house in Cannon Falls, and he'd hired a guy who was an architect and who also worked for the DNR.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking one day, and my dad must have told him that I was a landscape architect. And this architect said, well, as a matter of fact, the DNR Bureau of Engineering is looking for a landscape architect. Maybe your son should apply. Well, I did, and I got the job.
Hmm.
So that got us out of Duluth.
Yeah.
And I had no intention of spending my life with the state of Minnesota. But started there, primarily designing state park facilities. I think I saw every corner of the state.
Yeah,
that job. Yeah, we'd actually have to go to the park and look at the situation and try and figure out, you know, where we wanted this facility or that facility or whatever, and then come back in and draw it up and then it would be constructed that way. It could be a road, could be a campground, could be some planting around a building, could be any number of things.
Tell me about Tadaguchi. How did that come out of this?
One day I was asked to go up on the North Shore and do some work in various parks. One of them was George Crosby Manitou, which is quite far up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to meet with a surveyor by the name of John Tofty,
mm-hmm.
of the Tofty mm-hmm. family. And I did. Met with John, and we laid out an entrance road from U.S. 61 or whatever into the park. And when we were all done, John said that he'd like to show me something. So he took me to Tetagooch Camp, which was owned by a group of very wealthy men from Chicago. There may have been some Minneapolis folks in that too, but I know the owner and many of the folks are from Chicago. Well, I had not seen a place like this on the North Shore because it had at least two, possibly three inland lakes. It had trout. It was just gorgeous. The people had taken care of it, had never, you know, gone in and sawed down a bunch of timber or anything like that.
Right.
It was really, really beautiful.
Right.
A lot of maple and so on. I worked enough on the North Shore to realize, or to think, that we ought to be giving visitors something to do other than looking at waterfalls.
Right.
And that's kind of what it was all about. You'd drive up the shore, you'd pull over and risk your life getting from one side of the road to the other, and you'd look at the waterfalls and you'd take pictures, and then you'd get on your way and you go look at the next one.
Right.
And it just seemed to me that there ought to be something on the other side of the road that we could incorporate, if you will, and make a more profound experience for the visitor. I got back home and I started looking at some land records and figured out what the geographic layout of Tetagooch was in terms of its boundary, and realized that it could, you know, be fit in with Baptism River and so on, and some other areas that the state had already acquired and were using for outdoor recreation. And so I put together a map that showed how this whole thing could work.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed it to the director of state parks. He didn't like the idea.
Hmm. What was his problem? Just didn't have money, didn't want to make an investment? And
I'm not sure. I don't think he thought it was possible, or at least that's kind of how it came across to me.
Right.
But I knew through my research, I knew that the editor of the Red Wing Republican Eagle, whose name was Marshall, happened to be friends with the people who owned this camp. This guy Marshall, who also happened to be a friend of my dad's, my dad used the hospital in Red Wing,
mm-hmm.
had some association. But even better, Marshall had two sisters in Duluth that I'd work with and become very close to.
Okay.
And these were elderly women.
Okay.
And so
locals,
I told them, Julia and Carolyn Marshall. And so I was talking to them one day about this park possibility, and Julia particularly was just really high on parks and nature. And I think she did some talking with her brother, and her brother may have talked to the owners of the property, or there was some conversation that went back and forth between people. And I was completely out of the picture when this whole thing came about.
Hmm.
And now there's this possibility for this park on the shore. We called it North Shore State Park when we proposed it. We didn't call it Tetagooch.
Right.
But that's the name that emerged, and one thing led to another, and eventually there was a Tetagooch State Park.
Yeah. Interesting how things came together. Your past comes together, your father's connections, all of this stuff kind of comes together, gets the ball rolling. Even a skeptical
If I've been useful in one way over the years, it has been connecting people together.
Right.
In my work with the state, particularly, I had so many different jobs with so many different people. I can't tell you the number of times that somebody brought something up and I could say, you know, you really ought to talk to
so-and-so. Yeah, yeah.
And things happened.
Perfect.
And it was because of all of those associations.
Right.
So,
for somebody that really enjoys being alone, walking in nature with his dog, making all kinds of terrific connections, associations, to get something done on behalf of the state.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Well, the state or any entity, it didn't matter who it was. It just I just happened to know a lot of people and what they did and what their interests were and the capability to help somebody do something.
Yeah, that's awesome. But it's true. I mean, it's funny how, and it wasn't like you were seeking positions, seeking glory.
No, these are things that just happen. You know, as part of the job.
Right.
And you see, put two and two together and say, well, yeah.
Shortly after your work with the DNR, you worked with the governor's office and put together some proposals for the Voyageurs National Park or helped out with that. Can you explain that a little bit? Tell me a little bit about that.
When I was working for the DNR, Voyageurs National Park was a big issue. Basically, should the state of Minnesota support a national park?
And
if the state had not supported the park, there wouldn't have been one. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right.
So you get a new governor, Harold Levander, and Harold's a very, very nice man, but Harold didn't know much about the park, and he was getting a lot of pressure from a lot of people that there's enough federal land already in Minnesota with the whole Superior National Forest and the Boundary Waters, and we don't need any more. And it's just going to... So the governor asked the commissioner of DNR, Yarly Larfalum, to develop a report that would summarize the issues surrounding the park.
Okay.
Not to take a position.
Okay.
But just summarize the pros and cons. And Yarly's second in command, deputy commissioner, was Bob Herbst. Bob was a real wheeler dealer. I mean, in a good way.
Right.
And anyway, Yarly sort of gave the thing to Bob, and Bob decided that he would ask me and a forester to put the report together. So we did. We did a lot of research. We compiled this report. And based on that report, which I must say kind of took a positive bent to things, not intentionally, but the governor decided it would be a good idea.
Yeah, right.
The commissioner of DNR did not think it was a good idea at all. And the governor, at a conference with the National Park Service and so on, announced that he would support the park. So then the governor was advised, somebody told Levander that he really ought to appoint an interdepartmental committee of department heads to watch this thing, work with it. Oh, and the chair of the committee would be Kim Whitney, J. Kimball Whitney, one of the most favorite people in the world in my life. He would be the chair of the committee. And he was the head of the Department of Tourism and Economic Development. And so I officed with them. A bunch of good people. Just fun. Over the course of a number of years, I worked for that committee. I worked with Congress. I worked with the Park Service very closely. I worked with Governor Elmer former Governor Elmer Anderson. And, I mean, I was literally the...
The go-to guy?
I was kind of the voice of Voyageurs Park for the administration, let's put it that way. I don't want to make...
So, talk to Roger. You want to...
Well, that was right. We worked on that and worked on that. John Blotnick was the key. John was a representative. John was chair of the House Public Works Committee, and John eventually supported the park. Once John supported it, it went through. Nixon signed the bill.
So we're about 15 years out of high school graduation, and you're already in the middle of doing work with the state of Minnesota in a pretty high-profile position.
That was pretty heady.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
Because of the people that I got to work with,
And you, according to your CV, work with the state planning agency. You know what I'm interested in talking about is a little bit of what you were talking about in the car as we came back down from Grantsburg. You're talking about the signage and different things. Was that a part of the statutory stuff that you were doing with the park and open space planning when you asked to start developing recreation and historic preservation facilities with signage and information? When I go to a monument in Minnesota, I see what I'm looking at, there's an explanation. Is that a part of the work that you're doing in the background at that time?
Through my work with the National Park Service, I came to appreciate what a national park was.
Right.
It wasn't just some chunk of land that a congressman thought ought to be added to the system, or in Minnesota's case, some chunk of land that some state legislature thought ought to become a state park.
Right.
National parks are created to preserve protect, and whatever, the great landscapes of the United States. So you have mountains, and you have deserts, and you have seashores, and you have now the boreal forest in Minnesota, and so on. You don't have junk.
Right.
Excuse me.
Right.
You have truly representative examples of the great landscapes of Minnesota, of the United States. When I worked for DNR before the National Park Service, I would get an assignment to do something with a state park, and there was no thought given about, in my view, how it ought to be managed or why it was really a state park or whatever. There's the concern was, how do we build an entrance road into it? Or if it's established, where do we put a campground? Or where do we put a picnic ground? Or where do we put this and where do we put that? There was no interpretation. There were no interpretive specialists on DNR staff. And it seemed to me that if these were supposed to be things like national parks, then there ought to be somebody who can tell people what it is they're seeing when they're in the park. Or if not somebody, there ought to be literature and so on that explains that whole thing.
And just an aside, I mean, as you know, today, that's number one.
It's gotten better.
What all these, well, it's, I don't know about the state of Minnesota, but I know nationally.
It's gotten better.
Right.
So, so I went to work, okay, so well, the park thing was still brewing. I transferred to the state planning agency. I don't remember exactly why that was. Oh, because I was no longer in DNR. I was with Kim Whitney in economic development, and I think he was thinking that, you know, this is no longer a function that has to be in economic development, so, you know, I ought to go to state planning or whatever. And state planning was really a very freewheeling organization at that time. A lot of authority. They had their fingers in everybody's business. It was a microcosm of state government. There was a part of the planning agency that overlapped just about every state department. There was a group in transportation. There was a group in human services. There was a group in health. There was a group in the environment. That's where I ended up, and so on and so on. So, there was a, this gets very
into the weeds,
confusing.
There
was a very powerful legislative committee called the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, and it was made up of an equal number of House members and Senate members, and the chairmanship would rotate between Democrat, Republican, House, and Senate every 2 years, I think. I think they were on a biennial basis. And they had a staff person whose name was Bob Edmond. And Bob, a lot of people didn't like Bob Edmond because nobody really knew what Bob Edmond was doing. And Bob was very, very close to some very, very important legislators with a lot of power. And Bob Edmond and my boss happened to be good friends. And how that happened, I have no idea. Joe Sizer was black. And I don't know what I mean by that, except with Joe, you never thought he was black. And he had been buddies with this Bob Edmond. And the LCMR had gotten passed, and they kind of wrote their own laws, a law and an appropriation to the planning agency for a study of the total environment, is what it was called. And
ambitious.
I was, and so when I went to work for state planning, I was asked to head up the study for the total environment. And I immediately started talking with people about a study of the status of outdoor recreation in Minnesota. Screw the rest of the environment. Let's concentrate. I mean, you can't do a study of the total environment anyway. So I started to apply the reasons for federal facilities, parks, recreation areas, historic sites, and so on, to those same facilities in Minnesota.
Right.
And this gets confusing. Well, in order to have parks then that represented the great landscapes of the state of Minnesota, we had to figure out what they were.
Right.
And so a wonderful young man who just recently passed away, Don Yeager, was working for me. And Don was a geologist, a geographer from the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Good friends of John Borchert and all kinds of other people mm-hmm. over there. And he was, oh God, I don't know, 20 years younger than I am, 10 years, 15, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He had friends. And he was brilliant. And through his work and through his contact with other people, primarily at the university, as well as a private geologist named Rudy Hogberg. I don't know how I remember all these names.
Yeah.
We put together a map of Minnesota that I honestly think was the first time that showed what we call landscape regions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had the North Shore. We called them things that we
right.
thought made sense. We had the North
right.
Shore. We had the Prairie of the West. We had the Oak Forest. We had the Driftless area down around Rochester and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And something else up northwest. And there were people that just absolutely disagreed with that. They said, that's ridiculous. They didn't think of it, you know. So
right.
And base outdoor recreation on that was just insane. So anyway, that was one part of it. Okay, we had all
right.
these experts come together and work with Don primarily.
Right.
I can't take credit for that. And
right.
he came up with these landscape regions. And we also incorporated a little bit of human history in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember just exactly how that got stirred into the mix, but it
mm-hmm.
did. And so then we came up with this classification. Oh, and then we put a team together, including my old boss from Duluth,
mm-hmm.
and some people from DNR and various, Don and I and a consultant. And we traveled the state, and we looked at every single state park and state wayside and state this
hmm.
and state that, every
mm-hmm.
single one,
mm-hmm.
and we rated them.
Right. Right.
We had a,
so
we had a
hands-on
we had,
survey.
We had
yeah,
a
yeah.
rating, a rating system, and we rated them.
Huh.
And we brought all that back, and not on there is the work that I did with the Minnesota Zoo. I did some work with the Minnesota Zoo Board. Part of what the Zoo Board did was to develop a ranking of sites where the new Minnesota Zoo might go.
Okay.
And they had a firm called InterDesign that included a guy who was a computer whiz. And he put together a program for analyzing all the rankings for these computer sites and came up with the site in Apple Valley.
Okay.
So I said, hey, let's use
right.
Joe
right.
to feed all of these ratings
right.
into his computer system and
right.
come up with an analysis of what ought to be a park, what ought to be a historic site, what ought to be a recreation area, and so
right.
on and so forth. And
right.
we had definitions of all these areas.
Right, right.
So he spit this thing out.
Right.
And of course, it knocked just a whole bunch of them off the top. You
right.
know? Well, they ought to be county parks.
Right.
And good parks, but
right.
they ought to be county parks.
Right.
Right. So that went before the legislature, and of course, the local populace in those areas just went absolutely out of their minds.
Nuts.
We're not going to lose the designation
what?
Of the state park because
what?
That's tourism and money
what?
And all.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that didn't go much of anywhere.
Yeah.
But it still made it. But it made a point
right.
with this legislative committee, the funding
right.
thing in the first place.
Mm.
And so we also made recommendations. In fact, I wrote a bill called the Outdoor Recreation Act of 1972.
Right.
And in that, we made it clear that DNR parks had certain that each one of these areas, these titles, these state parks, state recreation, whatever, meant certain things. And it was very detailed.
Right.
and what the, each one meant, how it ought to be managed, how it ought to be
this.
And if that's what you got, then that's the way you treat it.
Right.
And one of the things that we did, which really pissed DNR off, is that we took all the historic sites away from DNR and gave them to Russ Ridley and the Historical Society.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because the Historical Society knew what the hell they were doing with a historic site.
Right.
And DNR Parks had not a clue about what to do. Not only how to reconstruct it or refurbish it if it needed refurbishing, but to interpret it, to manage it. That wasn't their ball.
Right.
But that had been what they did all these years,
right,
with the exception of a few, you know. So even at Fort Snelling, the historic part of Fort Snelling went to Russ Ridley.
Okay.
Taken away from DNR.
Yeah.
And so on. And
well, there had to be, I can't imagine. Again, the politics are pretty complicated with all of that.
The bill passed.
Right.
And it laid out the specifics of each one, and it also laid out who managed each one. Actually,
From the state level, right?
All state level. And then we also had, as part of that Outdoor Recreation Act, the fact that there had to be a master plan developed for every park. You can't just have something and say, okay, this is the land area, and we're going to put this there and this there.
We'll hire
some. No, you got to look at it. You got to
analyze
the vegetation, analyze the everything.
Right.
The Legislative Commission of Minnesota Resources gave us the responsibility for overseeing the planning process, and they gave us the money, which we would allocate to DNR to do the planning.
Right.
I mean, there was open warfare.
I bet.
But that was the legislature.
Right.
They believed in this system.
Right.
And that's what they wanted to happen. So we had authority that, I mean, I kind of question even now. But it worked. And it caused the planners, well, first of all, they actually developed a planning section that had, God, I don't know, four or five young, most of them landscape architects, who came to work for DNR to do the master plans for the various parks. Because they couldn't spend any money in the parks or do anything until they developed a master plan that was approved by us. And it just went on and on and on. I mean, I think back at these things, John, and I just wonder how in the world did they ever come to be?
Right.
I mean, they're just so unlikely.
I just think the time was ripe. I mean, I think there was a fair amount of education going on through Minnesota at that time, and there was an appetite for that. And I think that prior generation, which worried about vendors and fish being in the lakes, probably had to acknowledge the change. People want more out of the parks.
I remember an employee from DNR, who worked at Fort Snelling State Park, and she was the only, and I don't know that her title was interpretive naturalist, but she was the only person who had the heart to be an interpretive naturalist. And one day she came to our office and she cried. She cried for the fact that we had included interpretation so strongly in the legislation, and the DNR couldn't ignore it anymore, and that there weren't any other interpreters, and now there are.
Now
there are
all over.
But I'm reluctant to talk about this stuff because I'm not gonna. I know you didn't do that kind of thing. it couldn't be. How did it ever come about that? Number one, I got to work on Winters Park.
Right.
How did it come about that I ever was given an opportunity to use that knowledge to help create a state system?
Right.
How did it ever come about that, of all the people in state government, I was asked to be a liaison with the Minnesota Zoo Board?
Right.
That happened to use a computer system.
Well, yeah.
That was useful in
made it happen.
In trying to figure out what parks ought to be parks.
Right.
I mean, they're just all of these, and that's kind of what this book is about.
Right.
How?
Right. What?
Walked down the hall one day. And the commissioner says, how'd you like to do something new? I said, what do you got in mind? He said, how'd you like to head up a mediation service?
Right.
I mean.
Right. Right. Well, it's your skill set, obviously.
No, I don't know.
No, it is.
I don't know.
It is.
I really don't know.
You are a servant of the people.
No, don't do that. That's just.
Well, I know that just, you're more humble than you need to be, because how that all comes about is through somebody who's paying attention, who loves the outdoors, who is able to be civil and honest at the same time, and sell good ideas. I mean, these are good ideas. Which leads us to the last piece, that whole dispute resolution. You spent, it looks like, almost most of your career in the state.
Yeah, 15
working there. Anything in that part of your career that stands out to you that you'd like to share? I mean, that's a real swath of time professionally, so I'm sure you had a number of things. But what about the skill set to do that, Roger? What do you need to do that? You need to be able to. Man, you have to be organized. You have to be respected.
I wonder if people thought I was adaptable.
Yeah,
I took a test, well, kind of a test, through Kiwanis,
mm-hmm.
or through Optimist Club,
mm-hmm.
not too long ago, about your skills and so on and so forth.
Right.
And adaptability was one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if people saw me as someone who was adaptable enough to be asked to do this, do that, even though it hadn't been done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, why... Like I said, you walk down the hall, the commissioner says you want to do something new. Well,
right.
How many other people did you meet in the hallway?
Right.
Me, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
I said, well, you know, he told me what it was, and I said, well, I don't know anything about mediation. And he said, well, I guess I said, give me a day to think about it. Do it.
Right.
It's a whole new opportunity.
Right.
And so I did. And we became the, I think, fifth state office of dispute resolution in the country.
Well, it's
they had a head start on us, the other four or five, New Jersey, Florida, Massachusetts, Wisconsin.
Now, did you use, were you in the creation part of this? Were you creating this as you went?
It was non-existent.
You were just kind of...
It was non-existent.
So the precedents were being set because that's what we did last. I mean, you're just building a system of how to deal with litigations and
immediate
disputes.
I hired a firm from Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
Who was on the cutting edge of mediation service. They
okay.
were pretty. They were private, for-profit firm.
Right.
And they did a lot of teaching, and so I hired them to come out and give me a 40-hour training session, and
mm-hmm.
we also trained
mm-hmm.
at the same time. We invited the administrative law judges
mm-hmm.
From the state
mm-hmm.
To attend. So there were like six or seven of us, whatever,
mm-hmm.
eight of us, who learned mediation over the course of 40 hours in 1 week, and that was it. That was my training.
Mm. There's,
but I was also introduced to people locally.
Right.
Nonprofits and the like,
right.
that had been practicing mediation for a while, and they kind of took me under their wing, thank goodness. And so the first cases that I did were sort of as I helped, let's put it that way. I'm
right.
trying to think of a word and I can't think of it. Apprentice.
Right.
So I gradually, you know, got my feet on the ground, and then we did. And I guess I did a few cases, and then almost immediately we decided, I don't know who we is anymore, decided
mm-hmm.
that we also wanted to do special education mediation,
mm-hmm.
make that a part of the office.
Mm-hmm.
I was primarily doing disputes between public agencies,
right.
policy disputes and the like.
Right.
And so I hired a person to head up the special ed program. We put out a request for people who wanted to be mediators, and put together a panel, and we hired there were local mediation professionals that came together to train those people and taught them all how to be mediators.
Right.
Rob Friedlander first, and then later another, he passed away from cancer, another person took over the program. And so when the Department of Education would have a problem with a parent over an IEP or whatever the case might be, they would call us. Barbara would take care of it. She would assign a mediator. Mediator would go and do the case, and so on and so forth. And then we also were asked to mediate human rights disputes, so I hired another person and had training for, and we used many of the same mediators that had trained for special education, because by then they had quite a bit of experience. So we were also dispatched to do mediation for the Department of Human Rights whenever there was a, you know, something. Discrimination dispute or whatever the case might be. So it really broadened the office to do both all the political stuff and the public policy stuff, plus special ed, plus human rights. The other thing that we did that I think was useful is that we trained public employees at any level, regular. About, I'd say we did four-year trainings. And I would talk about being basic. I prepared a brochure. My daughter, who's a graphic designer, did a little logo for us and whatever. And we'd explain what conflict resolution was all about. Training people to recognize conflict and how to better deal with it. And there were so many people that were just grateful. I said, God, you know, it's so simple. It's so simple. You just, but we don't think about this stuff. And so training was a big part of what we did. And we did all of this on a $100,000 budget. But it was fun. I had no intention of working for the state for 30 years. It was a ticket out of Duluth. That was it.
Well, and you also changed things up. I mean, you weren't sitting there for 30 years.
I would have gone nuts doing the same thing. The fun part of it.
By the time you were 45, you had, most of this stuff had been going on. You were taking advantage of all the energies and all the skill sets that you had when you were young.
I was very fortunate.
That's awesome. I've
been given those opportunities.
That's awesome. Roger, thanks so much for talking today for this Thinking It Through. I appreciate everything that you've done on behalf of Minnesotans. I guess I thank you for them as well.
Thank you, John. It was fun.
Thanks, Roger.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Roger Williams. It certainly allows me to pause a bit when I think about bureaucrats over at the state capitol not doing my bidding. Au contraire, Roger Williams was a man of the people and certainly has made a difference to my life, both out recreationally as well as within education by mediating conflicts and getting involved with things like special education. The next interview we have coming up is with an anthropologist who lives in New Mexico, Nancy Nelson. Thanks for listening today. And we'll see you next time. This is Thinking It Through, and my name is John Lund.